This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Styra.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I got a friend here. This is Kelly Mack. He's the principal at Workbench. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly.
Hey, Dan. Great. Thanks for having me.
So let's start as we start every podcast. I want to know about your journey. How did you start in this crazy world called cloud native slash VC world? I want to talk about that, all of that.
For sure. It's for the viewers and the listeners. We had a quick chat before to like help prep me for how I should tell my story. And I'm trying to think of how far back I should go, but
first hand on keyboard ever. That's how people
first
start.
First hand on keyboard, man. I mean, grew up, I guess, just playing random games. Well, I guess I have two brothers. I grew up in New Jersey. I have two brothers.
Hold on, what part of Jersey? Let's talk. What part of Jersey?
I'm from Somerset County, a town called Warren.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's famous, but sometimes I say Warren and they're like, "Oh, I know that." And I'm like, "Do you?" And they usually think of the Western County, but I'm like 40 minutes outside the city. But yeah, a small little town called Warren. And fun fact, actually, my colleague Jess, we went to the same high school, and so it's a crazy small world.
But let me ask you this, Kelly: how many times you've been to the TikTok Diner in Clifton or White Manor? You know, you've been to the White Manor. Everybody's been there at least once.
I actually haven't, and the reason why is because that is closer. That's just more north, and I find that my childhood growing up was being in the Somerset County, just like Warren, Bridgewater, like Summit area, and then my weekends were going to Chinatown in New York City because that's where my parents grew up, and that's where my grandma is, and that's kind of it. So Unfortunately, I'm familiar with White Manor and all the good stuff that like Bergen County has to offer you, yeah, and just like the surrounding New York area. But I guess I didn't get a chance to enjoy it. I'm lame.
Well, I'll tell you something. When I first came to New York, I literally survived on pork buns from Chinatown. Like that was my sustenance, man. I was like, oh, it was one place. And I was like, I went there all the time, like a religion. And so it was just like, man, like, hey, that's a great upbringing. It's like you split the time between Chinatown and like, you know, being like near, you know, some in Bergen County and stuff like that. So, wow. So, yeah. So you're playing games. What games did you play?
I feel like growing up, we had all the consoles. I mean, we had PlayStation, we had Xbox, grew up like playing Sega. We'd play, like Altered Beast. I remember like going to my, you know, neighbor's house. We'd do a little piano lesson and play Altered Beast while I waited for our parents to come home to make sure that we're all right and could be home by ourselves. But,
you know, Kelly, this is where I put the graphic rise from your grave right here.
Yeah. I'm trying to, you know, what's hard is, you know, talking publicly about the games I play. I want to make sure that the games I say are cool. Cause I don't know if you want to know that the games I typically played were like, I don't know if you remember this, but there's a claymation game. It was like a claymation fighting game. It was similar to Killer Instinct, but we played that a lot.
Clay Fighter.
Oh, Clay Fighter. Yeah. We played a lot of those, I guess.
Kelly, you don't go through life with this tattoo here without like knowing all this stuff here. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, I saw that the new movie's coming out and I was just reminiscing on how good the old one was, where I watched that a bunch with my family and yeah, I have a lot of good memories. In fact, I recently watched the Street Fighter movie, which I know it's not related to Mortal Kombat, but just thinking back on those games you played and then they try to represent it in film, yeah. Dude, the Street Fighter movie with Jean-Claude Van Damme, he's a good guile. If they redid that movie, I don't know who they would get to play that. I don't. But anyways, yeah, I mean, I grew up playing a lot of video games on the spot. It's hard to say all the different random ones, but to this day, I play games, but it's really limited to Mario Tennis. and FIFA. So
let's go run the gamut. So, okay, you decide after gaming, you're like, okay, you know, parents are like, look, you got to go to school. You got to do things. Talk to me about that. Like, did you start in finance, computer science, a little of both? Like,
I have a very different background. So I went to college at Boston College, not to be confused with Boston University, but Boston College. And I studied physics and philosophy there. And it was really loved physics in high school, wanted to continue it during college. Grades sucked. I was like, hey, let me pick up philosophy because I like that too. And it boosted my grades. It was amazing. So pro tip to anybody that's out there still in college and considering like, hey, should I add a double major? If you add philosophy, it's possible that you can boost your grades just through that. But anyways, after I graduated, I didn't have the typical job experience where it was like, I mean, I just didn't really know what I wanted to do even through senior year. And so what I ended up deciding is I didn't want to continue on the academic path and, you know, get my master's or my PhD for physics. And so I decided to see what type of job I could get in the market and really focus on things that were related to research. And that's when I ended up at Forrester Research, which is an IT market research company based out of Cambridge, Boston, Mass. I worked there for about 5 years where I covered security, covered the cybersecurity market. And I'd say that's really where I ended up cutting my teeth when it comes to tech, specifically for enterprise tech too.
Philosophy major to cybersecurity. I need to understand that. Look, I'm gonna ask that question because people listening to this and watching this are like, how do we connect those two things together?
Everything's connected, right? With philosophy.
You're not getting off on that answer, man. I want some more meat, man.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what it is that my background from education standpoint was, you know, was basically qualitative and quantitative research. The quantitative research was physics and the qualitative research was philosophy. And in both domains, regardless which one you study, it's always about synthesizing knowledge and then repeating it or transmitting it, communicating it to somebody else. And so I got to Forrester and I started learning this new domain, which is cybersecurity and infrastructure. And again, the job was as an analyst to take a lot of research calls. Those research calls can be with practitioners. It'll be with the vendors themselves. It would be with industry partners. And it'd just be like, hey, trying to take all of those conversations, understand what's happening, and then communicate all that knowledge to somebody else, whether that is a buyer, so that they can understand, hey, what technologies should I adopt to help better protect my organization, or help a vendor say, hey, these are the areas that you should be focusing on and messaging yourself so that you are seen better in the eyes of your customer, or at least like develop your product roadmap in a way that people care. And then really what ended up happening is,
can we double click on that though?
Yeah, yeah.
So developing somebody, and again, we're going to get into the workbench piece, but like developing somebody's roadmap, that takes another special skill. Again, you talked about the synthesis aspect of it. I think really good companies that succeed are the ones that literally put their customer first, ask what's going on, understand their workflows, and bring this expertise and kind of inject that together. Tell me about that. Like, tell me about that process.
Yeah, well, what I guess as a Forrester analyst, you get the benefit of seeing a lot of pitches, and you get the benefit of seeing again what the customer pain point is, and you get to see what all the different like approaches are from the vendors. And this is not necessarily always a technical thing. Many times it's just like, oh, how you word it, who you're targeting, all those aspects, right? But exactly to your point, one of the big things that Forrester was pushing for was the idea of customer obsession. And if you take something like security, customer obsession for a security domain is very much making security professionals feel empowered so that they can push their business forward and be a part of the conversation of digital transformation, be part of the conversation of just, you know, growing the top line and not just being the, you know, the cost center and just being that office of no. So a lot of what we did at Forrester when it comes to research for security and risk was, well, how do we better prepare, I guess, security practitioners with that knowledge to communicate the value of security? And then on the vendor side is, how do we help them communicate to the customers of when you use us or whatever, like whatever kind of outcome that they have together, like this will help your organization like be more in tune with your business.
Got it. That's fantastic stuff. So we're at Forrester, Cambridge, shout out Charles Hotel, awesome place in Cambridge. I get nothing for that. All right. I'm giving you some free plugs. I'm cloud native darling right here. All right.
Anyway. Man, I feel like this might be the theme of our chat, but it's always, you know, these really awesome places like the Charles Hotel, which I mean, I was in Boston for so many years. I actually never went, but I always heard about how cool it was.
Dude, Henrietta's Kitchen. Shout out to Henrietta's Kitchen. One of the greatest brunches I've ever had in my life. Anyway, moving on. Don't take me off my path, Kelly. I'm a journalist. All right. So, okay. We got the Forrester thing done. Talk to me how you got to Workbench. Let's get to there.
Yeah. So, midway through my Forrester journey, I moved from Boston to New York. So my now wife, had to follow her. She, you know, she moved to New York and I was like, you know, I think it's time for me to come back home. I always knew I'd come back to New York City. I mean, my family's in the tri-state area, so I was bound to come back, and then was the time. But as I worked in New York, I started just getting more plugged in with the New York ecosystem. And one of my close colleagues at work left to join Workbench. I was like, oh, what's that? And he mentioned it was a VC. And I was like, you know, at the time being an analyst at Forrester, I thought that was interesting. I talked to startups all the time. And I always found that startups were on the forefront of innovation. And many times when we're talking to our own clients that are larger companies, like they can't necessarily use a startup because from a maturity standpoint or just from their own, both from like the startup maturity as well as like the maturity of the organization, there's sometimes it's incongruous for them to actually work together. But the startups always, you know, pointed in the direction of where the world is going. And I was always fascinated by that. And is the fun of research, right? And research is not just synthesizing new ideas. It's not just like taking ideas and then synthesizing it. It's always pushing in the direction of also where you want the world to go. And so my colleague at Forrester went to Workbench. He then left, went to business school. Awesome, like, turn of events. Like he left, he suggested that I join Workbench. And really, Workbench is an early stage enterprise fund. It's based in New York. And a big part of their mission is community. It's connecting with the Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 community of New York. It's connecting with the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And when you think about a VC connecting with the Fortune 1000, Global 2000 community, you need to interact with them with a level of trust, right? And my skill set coming from Forrester of doing, you know, consulting, advisory research was, hey, let's bring this analyst on board and it'll help us, you know, gather ideas and then present it to the corporate crowd and just basically garner just really nice organic relationships with them. And so I came on board, lead what we call corporate engagement, which is exactly as I'm mentioning, business development for the fund so that we can create some really nice relationships with folks across the C-suite as well as middle management and individual contributors that affect the work that we do. And then also focus on our infrastructure and security investments.
So let's talk a little bit about, Workbench. Again, New York based, you know, I've heard of you and, you know, we've probably done some events and more being at the same events as whatever it is, but great thing. Again, the whole community aspect, I think that's so different than other VCs that are out there. You're not intermingling. It's just whatever. Like, you know, I had Lenny Pruse on from Amplify, great dude from Amplify Partners. And, you know, we talked about the evaluation process. So taking that Forrester process, right? Let's just talk about, I'm a startup right now. Why would I use, you know, why would I go with Workbench as my VC or, you know, my partner?
Yeah. So the pitch is Workbench early stage enterprise fund focused primarily on seed to Series A, $3 to $6 million rounds post product. Our background comes from that ex-Forrester. My colleague John was in IT at Morgan Stanley. My colleague Jess was in learning and development at Cisco. We've been on the corporate side. We understand what those pain points are. And we're not, you know, shooting darts in the dark. What we're doing is focusing on some of the major pain points that we saw within large enterprises across data and analytics, infrastructure, security, future of work. And we're thesis driven in the areas that we care about, because not only have we researched and, you know, created a thesis about a topic, but we've also gone out into the ecosystem, talked with CISOs, talked to CTOs, talked to infrastructure and operations managers, security and pros in between, and identified like, hey, this is a massive trend. This is what people want. And then look out into the ecosystem to identify companies that resonate and really just play matchmaker. Throughout that process, I think our biggest strength is that we understand early stage go-to-market. We understand that it's hard when you build a product, how tough it can be from an enterprise sales process, getting in touch with the right person, navigating the organizational structure, messaging your product in a particular way, or really even building something that people want. And so what we bring to the table is that experience on the go-to-market side to help shape or to just at least lead you in the direction that hopefully, you know, can lead to success and you can find some, you know, nice fit with your customers. But on the other end, I mean, we've been building the community within New York for the past 8 years. As I mentioned, we have the corporate community, but we have this amazing entrepreneurial ecosystem. The genesis of Workbench was that there's this awesome enterprise atmosphere in New York, and what can we be doing to better capture that? We created a community that was all about, in the early days, it was about a physical workspace. We had companies like CoreOS, Cockroach Labs, and a bunch of others work out of it, of which some of them are portfolio companies. Along with that, we've hosted like a whole array of developer launches. We have this monthly meetup called New York Enterprise Tech Meetup, which is happening next week, featuring the CEO of Twilio, Jeff Lawson. So if anybody listening or yourself, Dan, you should totally join. It's going to be an awesome event. But I mean, we've been hosting these events for years and developing this really awesome organic community, where at the end of the day, if you're a developer oriented product, hey, we have this developer community, and it's, you know, it's a community that you can stress test your idea or get that early growth with. If you're building a mid-market product focused on customer success, hey, we've built this awesome community of customer success leaders across these mid-market companies. Similarly, for all the, you know, moving up the ladder to, you know, Fortune 500 to general, like, you know, retail customers here in New York, et cetera.
That's great. And again, this will be airing probably after that. So if it's recorded, maybe we'll put a link to it when we air this or something like that. But the other thing,
sounds good.
this will be an ongoing thing, right? So like, meaning like, if you know, you do these developer lunches and with different portfolio companies, it's awesome just for people to join and be part of it. Let me ask you a kind of a side question here. With the fun that we've had, with the pandemic, it really is hard to have that. People are like, it's kind of, you're having to build a remote culture for New York, right? How have you been able to cope? You know, is what helps, what, you know, how are you keeping the folks together in that community that you all, you know, we built in New York and stuff? So,
yeah, that's a really good question. There's definitely a huge Zoom fatigue. I know we're Zooming right now, but I love it because you're asking me a fun question. But there's definitely Zoom fatigue, and it's tough to just to basically be different. But what I've found is we've been doing this for a couple of years. The people that we have in our network are organic relationships where we just have a lot of goodwill. And when it comes to events, I've found that there's what people are looking for is value. And the value that we usually provide is the connection. It's the connection, but specifically from a learning perspective, because yeah, I mean, we could like spin up a Zoom and, you know, we could all chit chat and you know, drink beers and or whatever and like chill at some point, but when we create really focused ones. So as an example, today we actually hosted a sales lunch specifically focused on early stage enterprise sales. How do you enable SDRs to best deliver, like from a playbook perspective on what those cold outreach emails should be, to what the drip campaign should be from an automated perspective. And every enterprise company goes through those challenges. So as long as you can keep your content super tailored on tactical things that people like actually want to learn about, I find that that's the way that you can keep the community running. It's just providing real value and just not wasting people's time.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And again, please invite me. I'll join. I'd love to be there.
Yeah, you're
my new best friend. That's it. That's just what it is. So I'm going to ask you about some of the portfolio companies. You talked about CoreOS. Let's let you know. And then, you know, I have a soft spot for CoreOS in my heart. Yeah. Like a lot of friends from there. Shout out Steve Augustus, who's still really pissed at you. You have a 212 number. Anyway,
yeah, that's our mutual. How dare you?
Augustus meter. Boom. All right. So talk to me about like, okay, you know, what did you all see in CoreOS? Because think about this. There was no Kubernetes, right? There was Google's, you know, spinoff of this and whatever. And what did you all see in that company? I need to know that.
Yeah. So our thesis at the end of the day was community driven. The genesis of the relationship with CoreOS was we were close with the Quay folks. So Jake, Joey, Jimmy, I think you know them, but
yeah, Jimmy's been on. He'll probably have aired before.
Okay, yeah. So we knew them. They worked out of our space. They were acquired by CoreOS, and again, I mean, we had an awesome physical space. They worked out of it. We built a nice relationship. We were not yet investors, but what we ended up seeing when we looked into the market was that there were three main players within the container orchestration space. So it was Docker, Mesos, and Kubernetes. And despite all the hoopla around Docker and Swarm, and then even with Mesos, what we were really excited about was actually the organic growth of Kubernetes from the open source ecosystem. Everybody we talked to was moving towards Kubernetes, despite, you know, everything else being used. And our bet was that the idea of Google infrastructure for everyone else, the idea that everybody was getting behind it, is that you want to bet on that groundswell, because that groundswell is going to just, you know, move everybody. Everything's just going to move in that direction. And the CoreOS folks had a really distinct value prop around how to get folks actually operationalizing a lot of the container orchestration, container management technology that at the time was basically like, hey, yeah, there's Kubernetes, you go figure it out. Whereas CoreOS is trying to make that a lot easier. Obviously there are companies now that's trying to make it even more easier. I mean, but at the time, you know, the big bet was on Kubernetes, and turns out like that is what won.
Early on at, like, you know, again, at Sysdig where I work, it was like, we had to learn all three of them, but you saw that progression. I remember one sales kickoff we had at Loris, our founder, was like, Kubernetes is the bet. It's just it. And we saw it, and it literally spiked, and then everybody took it up. And, you know, shout out to CoreOS. It's just, you know, I think of, and I've said this a billion times, they're like the Beatles of, or like the, yeah, the Beatles of Kubernetes. They're the ones that, like, basically, like, this is, we're going to bring it to the masses. We're going to make it amazing. And, you know, and I'm happy that they got acquired. So shout out to Brandon and Polvi.
Sivo is an alternative to the big hyperscale cloud providers. They've launched the world's first managed Kubernetes service powered exclusively by K3S. With sub 90-second cluster launch times, a simplified Kubernetes experience, and predictable billing, Sivo is on a mission to create a better developer experience. Get $250 free credit to get started. Sign up today at civocloud.com/podcast. That's civo.com/podcast. Go check them out.
So, Cockroach Labs, right? Like, I know, like Spencer, those guys, just, you know, those folks over there, phenomenal people. What'd you see in them?
Yeah, same story actually. So Spencer, Peter, and Ben, as they were starting Cockroach, started it out of Workbench when we operated a physical workspace off of Fifth Ave. And really the thesis there was that the need for a distributed fault tolerant distributed SQL database is necessary. I mean, so many businesses are running off of SQL databases, but it's off of old vendors, right? Oracle, et cetera. And there was a need within the market from all the big banks that were heavily reliant on them for their transactional systems of, hey, there needs to be a better option. And they look again at a lot of the tech companies to say, like, well, what is a way that we can do this, right? And so when we heard the pitch around, hey, taking Spanner and making it available for everyone, well, it just made sense that this would then become that new de facto standard of which people can get the same type of benefit that Google had for the way that they provide their services. And so a lot of it was based on the team. A lot of it was based on that market opportunity. I mean, the team's phenomenal. So we're always excited about an awesome team. From a market opportunity, again, our bread and butter are just large banks, financial services. They're running super complex systems that just can't go down. And as they think for themselves about, staying on the forefront of technology and where technology is moving as it's moving to the cloud, well, how do they take what they're currently doing and bring it to the cloud? And bring it to the cloud in a risk adjusted way, so to speak, right? And something that will work for them. And that was really the big bet. We invested actually pre revenue, and so we didn't touch on this, but for us as a firm, we invest in early companies. We say early seed to Series A. We invest pre-revenue because way that we are able to de-risk that is to identify that market opportunity just through, our corporate network.
Incredible. Yeah. And like, again, and I've had, Cockroach, other folks that have left Google. I had Tilt on, Dan from Tilt, for instance. It's like, it's almost like they get out of Google and they're like, I want to give the world what they had inside there. And that to me is, there's a cottage industry of a bunch of engineers. They're like, okay, you can just tap into, like, for that, to have these amazing ideas and, taking them and making them for the masses. So it's incredible. I want to talk to you about a couple of newer names, and they're very, very impressive. One, we use at my company now, Catalyst, for customer success. And it's a great tool because you think about this, what did you have to do in the past to do this, to be able to customers in a spreadsheet or in Salesforce, it's all over the place. So what drew you to Catalyst and investing in them and, taking the time with them?
Yeah. So Catalyst, very interesting story. We built this community for so long in New York, and part of that community is the enterprise sales community. And actually, one of the co-founders of Catalyst had a sales meetup that he ran out of the Workbench office. And so we had just gotten to know him through that. And at the time, he was at DigitalOcean, I believe. But basically, fast forward a couple of years, they spin out of DigitalOcean and they're starting a new company focused on customer success, basically saying, the current state of customer success is hard because what you have in the market is Gainsight, and Gainsight's built off of Salesforce platform. And there are a bunch of contingencies that just make it really, really tough to use. And then to your point, it's heavily manual. But at the same time of that being shitty, it's like there's more and more demand on customer success to delight your customers, to help out with renewals, with help out, reducing churn, with upsells, et cetera. That idea of post-sales beyond just account management has just come to the forefront of just being super, super important. And what's really exciting about the Catalyst guys is that they did this at DigitalOcean, right? They didn't have a sales team. They had this amazing customer success team that helped DigitalOcean grow as a company and get all that revenue. And so what we were really drawn to is this idea of, hey, let's back founders that have lived the problem. Because if they've lived the problem, they have well, they know what to build, but then they can also gain that trust with the people that they end up selling to. Like when they talk to customer success folks, it's not like there's some academic just saying like, hey, I think this might be a better way to do it. It's more of, I did this and I don't think like you should go through the crap that we did.
Got it. I want to talk to you a little bit about Fire Hydrant. Tell me about them. What is Fire Hydrant? I don't know them.
Yeah. So Fire Hydrant's site reliability engineering platform, basic gist is you get an alert from PagerDuty, but then, you know, what's next? And so they help standardize, operationalize the entire process from runbooks of, you know, creating a ticket, assigning people that should be on the incident, and then help manage the process from communication and Slack, and then really help create those retrospectives and analytics to tell you, hey, this is what happened. And then here's how we can, you know, prevent this from happening in the future. The big idea was that everybody's under stress, it seemed. I was talking about customer success being under stress because you have crappy tools, but you have to, you know, upsell all these people. But it's the same for really every part of the organization. Because for site reliability engineers, platform engineers, you are expected to keep your systems running, right? 5-9s. But in order to do that, it's, you either have to be really, really smart and be like freaking amazing, or, you know, the question is like, how do you make it so that site reliability engineering does not fall onto like some superstar people? The site reliability engineering is something that engineers can do, and you can basically inject a process that has been, you know, evangelized by Google into something that, you know, everybody else can do.
Fantastic.
What you build and where it takes you shouldn't be limited by your database. CockroachDB helps developers build and scale apps with fewer obstacles, more freedom, and greater efficiency, so you can forget about the database and trust that it just works. Kubernetes-friendly, open source, and indestructible, CockroachDB makes it easier to build and scale apps. It gives companies the freedom to serve customers anywhere, and it's backed by world-class documentation and excellent dedicated support. Discover CockroachDB, the most highly evolved distributed SQL database on the planet. Kubernetes native and built from the ground up to help companies of all sizes, including Bose, Comcast, and Equifax, scale fast, survive anything, and thrive anywhere. Sign up for a free 30-day trial and get a free t-shirt at cockroachlabs.com/popcast. That's cockroachlabs.com/popcast.
Fantastic. Let's talk about Viso Trust.
Tell me about Viso Trust. I know it's not actually the typical, probably not your typical audience that would care about this, but I brought it up because, you know, I don't know how often you've been in the hot seat for, all right, you want to sell Sysdig, but someone's like, all right, well, fill out this security questionnaire, and you're like, all right, I guess we'll fill out this 200 question questionnaire and we'll get it back to you. But you know, that lead time is however long, and enterprise sales, the biggest killer is just time, right? The longer it takes, the longer like people's interest and everything in an enterprise sales cycle wanes, and it's hard to like get everybody on board. But basically, we saw that the security review vendor security process sucked, right? It sucks for the vendor. It's because like you have to fill that shit out. It sucks for...
It's an RFP process, but the redundant questions, and a lot of them are based on some type of like archaic thing, like, you know,
that's
like,
just developed over time. Right. It's just like a monster, it's a Frankenstein. And then on the opposite end, like honestly, for the organizations, it's really hard for them to do it, and it's the reason why they have these crappy questionnaires that they don't update. It's because it's hard to invest the resources in doing it. And so we found this company called Viso Trust. Again, they were previously CISOs. They've lived this problem at ASAP and Lending Club, and they wanted to fix it, starting with the organization, helping organizations actually go through the questionnaire process faster, which would then make it easier for a startup or a vendor to work with them. Not only are you then covering more vendors because you can go through the due diligence process in a much more automated way, but you can then obviously measure your risk a lot more accurately because you have better coverage of your entire ecosystem.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's one I'm going to recommend today. So that's fantastic. Great. I want to ask you about, there's an enterprise, but you can talk about the enterprise, New York's enterprise scene and the one that you cultivate with Workbench. I want to talk to you about this Enterprise Weekly newsletter. Tell the listeners and watchers of this, viewers, watchers. There's my Brooklyn coming out. where are you, why would I subscribe to this newsletter?
Yeah. So every Friday, and I think we might be on like our 300th something issue, but every Friday we send out a newsletter called Enterprise Weekly that sums up the top enterprise news from leading outlets like Wall Street Journal, TechCrunch, VentureBeat. So if you're going through the week and you're just, heads down in your work and you're not following like what's basically happening in the enterprise scenes, whether it's from an earnings perspective, whether it's some major releases or some, we'll also mention obviously things like hacks and breaches, then this is the opportunity for you at the end of the week to just say, hey, here are a couple of stories that we should be familiar with. And it's a nice quick read. We then, highlight like a startup in the ecosystem, not just our own portfolio company, just highlight startups that we call the startup of the week. And it's a digest of whatever happened that week specifically for enterprise folks.
We're going to have a link in the liner notes of the episode for everyone to go check that out. I'm going to ask my last question, Kelly, and I don't want this to end because I'm having such a great time with you, dude. So like, what work are you most proud of?
Oh man, the work that I'm most proud of, I guess I've been at Workbench for almost 5 years, and it's crazy to think that it's been almost 5 years, and I'm just proud of being a part of the company. It's been awesome. I mean, we're a small team. I don't know if this is like the answer you're looking for. Hopefully you can feel that it's genuine, but I've been with the team for 5 years. We're a small team, but we're constantly iterating. I mean, we're a VC, but we operate like a startup because we have to. We're making a name for ourselves. We're trying to get out there in the ecosystem. There's so much to learn. There's so many cool people to meet. And it's just, I'm just proud of having been part of the crew for the past almost 5 years and getting to do what I do.
Awesome. Well, shout out to Jonathan Lair, Steve Augustus as well, because they're like, oh, you're going to love Kelly. And I'm telling you, like, you lived up the expectations. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, dude.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
So you get to see how the sausage is made. takes a lot to make me look pretty. All right. So, here we, so let's, we'll take it from here.